If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise.
Hello, this is Best Practice, the show about management. I'm Richard Ady, and all will become clear with the teddy bears soon enough. The election of Donald Trump is still reverberating through cabinet offices and boardrooms around the world. Partly that's because of who he is and what he says he'll do, but partly it's because the prevailing wisdom was that this wasn't going to happen, and it did. This underlines how unpredictable the world is, something that business seems to understand well. Senior executives are expected to be comfortable with uncertainty. But the men you're about to meet, Kailash Awati and Paul Colmsey, say most management approaches are ill-equipped to deal with this unpredictability. Kailash, that's right, isn't it? You're actually pretty sceptical.
That's essentially right, Richard. We are very sceptical of them. And I think it basically boils down to this. Most management techniques are aimed at reducing ambiguity, but often they do a terrible job of it. And the book's essentially a sort of a response and a critique to that.
So would you go so far as to kind of write off the whole management consultancy industry?
Not at all. You see, actions and techniques have their place, but the question is, why are they being used? And that's the more interesting question. So if they're being used as an anxiety reducer, to reduce anxiety, then that's probably going to lead to the wrong outcome.
Paul, if I bring you in here, you actually do unpack this in the Heretic's Guide to Management. The thing is, we're very deeply uncomfortable with ambiguity, with uncertainty, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right. And there's neurological reasons for that. It's actually processed differently in the brain. And there's been various studies that have demonstrated this. And so the reason for that is a risk situation, even though there's a level of unknowns, you understand the rules. And so that's why people can happily, for example, have a dabble at the casino and play blackjack or poker or something. The rules aren't going to change on you. But in ambiguity, not only is there unknowns in terms of outcomes, but the rules change on you at the same time. And so that creates a lot of, I guess, dissonance. And it's actually, in terms of the brain, it's processed in the areas of the brain that govern emotional responses, which is why it tends to evoke feelings of anxiety.
But I am not aware of many, I suppose, management practices, certainly in Australia, that fully acknowledge this.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, it's almost a blind spot in a way that all of the management techniques actually aim to give you simplified models that seek to reduce things back to simplistic causes and effects. And of course, reality tends to impose itself, and those causes and effects don't always hold true in complex situations.
But there's comfort in thinking that they do.
Yeah, I guess it's the great appeal to management models and management practices is that they actually suggest that ambiguity can go away. But our contention is really it probably doesn't. And in actual fact, if you're driven by trying to make it go away, as Kailash said, it's probably not going to lead to great outcomes.
All right. Well, Kailash, give me an example of the kind of things that we're talking about happening in Australia where we're ignoring the fact that there's this ambiguity and it's actually causing problems for businesses.
Yeah, look, a common example is actually large IT projects. In general, what tends to happen is that there's a big investment made, there's a problem that's perceived as a problem, and what people do is they roll out a methodology, a way to manage a project, a way to run a project, but they don't actually spend time figuring out why they're doing something. And our contention is really that before you even jump into the specifics of doing something, what you first need to do is need to understand is why you're doing it. And I think the reason people jump into the doing as opposed to thinking about why they're doing it is that they just want to run to action. They want to see some results. And I think that's basically the problem here.
But surely people must understand why. Otherwise, why are they doing something? You can't want to do something spending perhaps millions of dollars just because it's better than doing nothing.
That's right. And what tends to happen very often in those cases is that you tend to bring in experts who've sort of done this before. And you tend to then follow a script that somebody gives to you. So say you're doing a big, say, enterprise resource planning project. Maybe a consultancy will come and tell you, we've done it many times before, and this is what you need to do. But that doesn't necessarily address your problem. It addresses a generic problem rather than a specific one. What you need to do before that is to figure out what your specific context and situation is before you actually do anything at all in terms of implementation. And what we think is that there's not enough time spent on that. So what people do is they run off and they put something to tender. People will come and tell them what to do without necessarily understanding what that specific organization's problem is.
In fact, they have a vested interest in doing exactly what they've always done, because totally. That's how they make their money.
So we actually use the metaphor there of a teddy bear. And, you know, a teddy bear is an anxiety reducer.
Right.
And what we contend is that people use these kinds of approaches because they reduce anxiety. You see, the problem really is that what we call the sense-making bit, the bit about understanding the problem that needs to be done, involves getting a lot of different people together, different people with different viewpoints together, and trying to come to a consensus. That is often seen as just talk, which is the reason why a lot of people will just simply skip over that point and basically do something that everybody else does, because it makes them feel better.
Paul, how do we address this? Because two things are leaping out at me. One is more reflection at the beginning, but the other one is it's quite confronting, because what you're dealing with most of the time is complexity, and yet it's human nature to tell ourselves simple stories.
Yeah, that's correct. And what Kailash alluded to with the teddy bears is part of the answer. So clearly, if you put everyone in a room with different thinking dispositions and different opinions on a complex problem that in itself is got all sorts of interlocking aspects, a lot of people will find that hugely anxiety-inducing because of the significance of ambiguity. In my own practice, I've tended to become adept at handing out teddy bears. And so
you're actually giving them to people?
Yeah, you almost symbolically do it. So to give you an example, if I was to do strategic planning these days and I've got a group of people in front of me that have to collaboratively work out what to do over the next 3 years, given complex circumstances, and there's a lot of disruption in various industries at the moment, the first thing I will do is usually I will put up a management 101 model, one of those diagrams that show vision, mission, focus areas, KPIs.
You're losing me already, but go on.
Yeah, I don't actually do it to explain what strategy is. It's simply to put there to reduce anxiety. It's literally me handing them a teddy bear saying, here's something familiar to you. You've all seen these sort of things before. Now, we're actually going to work on this bit over here. So rather than come in with all sorts of, with people with different expectations, I'm able to reduce their anxiety levels just by almost symbolically handing them something they're familiar with.
Is anyone actually better at confronting this complexity and ambiguity and actually dealing with it face on?
I think a sector that's actually reasonably good at it is the startups, because there, by definition, they have to actually deal with ambiguity, and it's a given. You know, so when you're actually starting something, you have to be ambiguity tolerant. So they tend to use processes and methods in a fit-for-purpose way, the way they should be used, and not just to reduce anxiety.
It's easier for them in a way, because they won't have an established culture, they won't have established processes, they've got no one saying, well, this is the way it's always worked.
You're absolutely right there, Richard. The thing is, the real problem in big organizations is precisely that. It's the hierarchies and the organizational structures and silos that get in the way. Very often, and this is one of those things that's a truth that maybe nobody will say too loudly, is that the project management office is the biggest enemy of projects.
Ooh. now I see why you guys are the heretics. I've got to ask, because one of the points that you make really early on is that management thinking tends to go in cycles, and it also tends to either embrace looking at process or looking at people. How sure of that are you?
Look, this is, again, something that's quite empirical. And, you know, what you're referring to is actually in a paper, highly cited paper by two academics from the States. And they did an analysis of management thought over the last 150 years. And this is something that they noticed, is that every decade or so, every generation or so, there's a swing from the rational side to, you know, what they call the human side.
Mm.
For us, the real sort of surprise was that this sort of resonated with the way the human mind works, is that when one is thinking emotionally, one's logical mode of thought is suppressed. And recent work in neurology sort of tends to confirm that. So it makes sense. Whether one can prove it or not is another matter altogether.
And where are we at the moment, Ganesh? Which cycle are we in?
We are in a very interesting place because what happened in the 90s was that there was this big move to this whole organization culture thing. You know, we must all be a family and imbibe the values.
And employee engagement.
That's
big,
right.
Big
thing.
And we know that employee engagement tends to be poor, and we're particularly bad at it in Australia.
Absolutely. And what's tending to happen now is because of the availability of different kinds of data, on what goes on in the workplace, is that we're moving back to scientific, rational way of looking at these things. In fact, a lot of what you see in social media is things like employee engagement. You know, can we actually get a handle on that through forums like Yammer or social media within the organization and so forth? Besides, there's an ever greater monitoring of what people do at their workplace, you know, people monitoring click-throughs on your computer and so forth. So I think we're moving back into a rational sort of era. And this is very, very driven by digital technologies right now.
I think the two of you have made clear that in a way, what we're telling ourselves is I'm going to use a word you may quibble with, fairy story, just to make ourselves feel a bit more comfortable. Paul, what is in fact the best way to approach the problems that we deal with and the complexity we face?
Okay, so this is going to sound like a pretty weird answer, but basically, the more directly you ask a question or the more directly you tackle a problem, particularly one that's complex or has a lot of ambiguity, the less likely you are to actually have success, believe it or not, as counterintuitive as that sounds.
Mm.
And so what we advocate in the book is actually there's an oblique approach. So an indirect approach is often the way to go, and that can range from the way you ask a question to the way you actually approach getting something done. Of course, that creates ambiguity, so you have to manage that. But actually, an indirect approach tends to work better than a direct approach. And there's a great quote in the book in relation to the difference between the way Bill Gates was looking at organizations versus Dunlap. And Bill Gates, his vision was to put a PC on every desk, and things like shareholder value came as a result of that, whereas Dunlap was looking at shareholder value as the end goal, and that was not as effective.
Yeah, his nickname was Chainsaw, and he was obsessed with cutting costs, whereas Bill Gates, well, really, he's a computer nerd, isn't he?
Absolutely, and that's a much more rich story that people can relate to.
Okay, so that's part of it. Don't go for it directly. It seems to me, though, Paul, that there's a problem with that, in that especially when you're starting out, but even after that, what the market wants, what often you're rewarded for, is strong statements of purpose, which say, this is what we're doing and this is how we're going to do it. And saying, well, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to come at it from the side. That's less convincing in a way.
Yeah, and this is why you have to almost symbolically hand out teddy bears. So in my practice, I've come to realize that asking indirect questions often gets me really great answers. But I can't just start out by asking an indirect question, because ambiguity goes through the roof and anxiety goes through the roof, and people are looking for that statement of direction and purpose. And so that's why almost symbolically handing people, in the form of a teddy bear, a reference to a process they're familiar with or a methodology they're familiar with, is a good way to sort of orient them to realize that, no, what we're talking about is within the bounds of what they understand. And I'm able to then successfully ask those questions and get the answers I need.
Kailash, are there examples in Australia of people who have done this, who've taken that kind of oblique approach, at least to begin with, but spelt it out and then found a way of succeeding?
Yeah, look, I think you will see a lot of that in the startup space, because typically what they're doing initially is they start out with a certain kind of a aim that's kind of ill-defined, and they refine it as they go along. So the point we want to make is that before you start to talk about specific goals, you've got to be in that ambiguous situation so that you can actually figure out and reframe some of your goals. And that's actually an important part of what we call the problem definition or the problem formulation phase. It's the art of actually doing that is what sense making is all about.
But Kailash, there is a paradox here, I think. I think there is now an understanding that to be effective as managers and leaders, people have to be comfortable with uncertainty and complexity. You're starting to see that, in fact, in the ads for positions, but we're still not, are we?
Yeah, and I think that's really the problem we're trying to address in this book, is how do you do that? What does that mean? How does ambiguity tolerance and uncertainty tolerance translate to the workplace? what are things, concrete things that managers can do? If you walk into a room as a manager and you know that you have to deal with a very difficult problem, everybody around that table is going to be in some way be anxious about what's going to happen because it affects their livelihood. So you've got to recognize what it is that's driving the anxieties and hand out teddy bears symbolically to reduce the anxiety level and get people to be thinking about the problem in a productive way.
All right, Paul, it seems to me that it's not just management and leaders being comfortable with uncertainty, but that ability of being able to make their team comfortable with uncertainty.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm reminded of a great quote from a leader in an organisation here in Western Australia who said, there are opportunities in the grey. That was what he said to his management team that we were coaching at the time. There's a whole bunch of complexities because once you come to grips with your own teddy bears, so to speak, and what you use to cope with ambiguity, you have to understand the teddy bears that your team uses, what's driving those, and how you can potentially replace them, symbolically hand them out at the right time. It's a real art form. I don't necessarily know if there's a science to it, but it's very much an art form. Good managers and great leaders know how to do that, and they know how their people tick.
Paul Colmsey and Kailash Awati are the authors of The Heretic's Guide to Management, The Art of Harnessing Ambiguity. You'll find details on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. Jargon Decoder has been one of the most popular segments on Best Practice. The woman behind it, Amanda Woodard, is jargoned out, but this hasn't stopped her from looking at office life with a perceptive eye. Now she's focusing on shared spaces at work, and we're going to start with the kitchen. Amanda, what are the rules here?
Well, they're generally unspoken rules, of course, and I suppose the first rule is that you don't steal anyone else's food. You know, you might covet that lovely macaroon that Joe has just bought from the local deli, but if you touch it, you're in deep water. I guess the second unspoken rule is that you clean up after yourself. You know, you don't leave that rotting tea bag in the sink, but you just walk a few paces and put it in the bin. And the third thing is there's an unspoken rule that you kind of should have respect for your fellow workers, so that you wouldn't do something that you wouldn't like done to yourself. And of course, there are health and safety issues here at play as well. You know, if you spill something on the floor and someone slips up on it, then the company's in real trouble. Or if you leave that scalding hot pan just on the side and someone burns themselves. There are serious issues at work here as well.
All right. Well, as you give me those unspoken rules, I'm thinking of all the problems and the many times I've seen all of those rules, I think, broken.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I've touched on the first one. There's food envy.
Yes.
So all these problems around food envy, and I've seen them happen many, many times. And then all the kind of passive-aggressive notes that go up, sort of identify who the culprit is quite amusing as well.
Can you remember anything, a specific passive-aggressive note?
Well, I do remember an occasion back in the UK where someone had taken a small pot of milk for their coffee and then a note went up shortly afterwards saying, I do hope you enjoyed that milk in your coffee because that was my expressed baby milk for my child later on this evening. that was a classic. Some people, of course, don't resort to passive-aggressive notes. There was another occasion, I remember, where someone told me they had constantly having their kind of homemade tomato sauce pinched from the fridge. So on one occasion, they decided to sort of spice it up with some really, really hot chilies in it. And that solved the problem. It was never stolen again after that. I think, you know, someone was seen clutching their throat, wandering around the office.
The thing with unspoken rules is that you are free to ignore them, really. You can claim you don't know about these unspoken rules. You can just say, well, this is how I am in my own kitchen at home.
Absolutely. I mean, there's all kinds of excuses. Oh, well, I didn't see it. Oh, well, it's not my job. I'm too busy. Doesn't the secretary do that? I don't know how to work the dishwasher. And I think the problem, as you say, Richard, is that we all bring different standards into the office. You know, what's cleanliness for me is probably completely different for you and someone else. And certainly my husband and I have very different ideas about what a clean kitchen looks like.
My wife and I have very different ideas about what a clean kitchen looks like. She can see things that I couldn't see except with a microscope.
Yeah, well, I'm with her on that one, you know. There's a kind of mental block, I think, perhaps sometimes with husband and wives on
issue. It's a Y chromosome disability.
So we have all these different standards coming in and butting up against each other. And big surprise, it breaks out into sort of what might seem petty disputes. But in fact, it's the same. If you have uncivil behaviour, whether it's doing your actual job or whether it's how you treat each other in the kitchen, it has kind of quite a negative, gnawing effect at people. And people who study these things say that it's actually very bad for employee engagement.
I can believe it, because if you are someone who is doing the tidying up, you're thinking, all these other people, they're free riders. They're just letting me be the scullery maid while they just swan off.
Mm.
And that's annoying.
It is very annoying. And I think this is why a lot of offices resort to having some structure around behaviour, because they can see that left to our own devices, it's just the laws of the jungle and no one's really going to take responsibility for what happens in the kitchen. So inevitably you get things like rotas introduced. I work in an office where there's that kind of system now. And woe betide, by the way, if you forget that it's your day for cleaning up. You know, you'll get a tap on the shoulder or a quiet whisper in the ear that there's a kitchen problem, and you go in and there's the equivalent of, you know, in crockery of the Leaning Tower of Pisa awaiting you to clear up. But at least they bring some structure around it and they get rid of those passive-aggressive notes. They perhaps bring all that frustration out into the open.
You do get the self-appointed kitchen monitor, don't you, in some workplaces?
Oh, yes, definitely. You get,
and that can be quite officious.
Yes, no, you definitely get someone who says, right, you know, unless all that food lying in the back of the fridge that can be carbon dated, it's so old, is thrown out.
Is this yours?
Yes, is this
they
yours?
They hold up the box or the bag in front of your workmates.
So, and they often say, okay, well, I'm throwing it out unless it's willingly disposed of and you come and find out what's yours and get rid of it, then it's going. Equally, I think, besides having a rota, offices sometimes resort to actually taking utensils away or saying, well, you know, if you can't be trusted to clean these utensils, clean these communal things that we've provided for you, then we're just going to have to bring in all your own stuff. And then somehow, because it's yours, there's this idea that you will treat it better and you will take it away with you and you'll clean it rather than just letting it to rot on the side.
I have to ask about this, even though I don't think it's quite related, and that is the mystery of the disappearing forks. Forks always go. We've got a communal kitchen at RN in Sydney and it's quite schmick, actually. It's rather beautiful. But the forks are always gone.
Yeah, the forks are the first to go, aren't they? Almost like as if they walk off on their own.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure about that.
What can we do about this? You've mentioned the rota, that we have the self-appointed kitchen monitor. Because what you don't want is to think, well, I don't want to just go off and make a cup of tea and come down with an illness because of what the kitchen's like.
Oh, no, absolutely. Well, there are a couple of things that I've read about that jumped to mind, and one I thought was quite interesting was that psychologists found that if you put in the kitchen a picture of a large pair of eyes, there's this kind of subliminal effect that it has of people feeling that they are being watched and behaving better as a consequence of that.
Even though they know it's just a picture.
Yeah, even though it's just a picture. And maybe it's the same thing as having a speed camera on the road. You know, you're kind of subliminally aware that there's one there, so you just take your foot off the pedal. I don't know what it is, but apparently it has an effect. Another one is the last person that you employ into the company. Make it part of their job description.
Ah, yes.
And then that's just something that's passed down. Every time you get some poor new person, then it becomes their job to clean up in the kitchen for a while. And so it's passed down. It certainly reinforces the hierarchy of an office,
method. I don't know. I think the eyes are probably a better idea.
I agree.
All right. Thank you very much, Amanda. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Amanda Woodard is the editor of HRM Online, the magazine of the Australian Human Resources Institute. And that's it for this week. Best Practice is produced by Moira Tadias. Our sound engineer is Joe Wallace, and I'm Richard Adie.